Today is Monday, November 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, Iraqi security forces open fire on a crowd of protesters trying to break into the Iranian consulate in the Shiite Muslim holy city of Karbala overnight.
Prime Minister Adel Abdul Mahdi appealed to protesters Sunday night to suspend their movement, which he said had achieved its goals and was hurting the economy. The premier said he is willing to resign if politicians agree on a replacement and promised a number of reforms. But protesters say that is not enough.
And we take a look at the significance of the Berlin Wall coming down 30 years ago this week. Those stories and more next. Iraqi security forces open fire on a crowd of protesters trying to break into the Iranian consulate in the Shiite Muslim holy city of Karbala overnight. At least three people have been killed. VOA's Jeff Custer reports.
Burning tires and chanting, "Iran out, Karbala remains free," a crowd assembled in front of the consulate late on Sunday. One protester said those gathered came to revolt and hold a protest in front of the Iranian consulate, pulling down the Iranian flag and lift the Iraqi flag instead. The Iraqi High Commission for Human Rights said people were killed by gunfire. It added that a dozen were injured, including security forces. Iraq's official human rights watchdog confirmed the deaths. The commission said the crowd tried to break into the consulate. Security sources said they also tried to set fire to it. On Monday, thousands of anti-government protesters had gathered in central Baghdad, defying the prime minister's plea to end protests he says are costing Iraq's economy billions of dollars and disrupting daily life. The protests have broken nearly 2 years of relative stability in Iraq since they started October 1st in the capital and spread to the impoverished southern Shiite heartland. More than 250 people have been killed. Despite the country's oil wealth, many people live in poverty, with limited access to clean water, electricity, health care, or education. A protester, who didn't wish to be identified, says the nation's youth have lived through economic hardships, explosions, and depression. They want to root out the political elite completely. Prime Minister Adel Abdul Mahdi appealed to protesters Sunday night to suspend their movement, which he said had achieved its goals and was hurting the economy. The premier said he is willing to resign if politicians agree on a replacement and promised a number of reforms. But protesters say that is not enough, and the entire political class needs to go. The anger over economic hardship and corruption is aimed at the sectarian power-sharing system of governance introduced in Iraq in 2003 and the political elites benefiting from it. The political class is seen by many as subservient to one or other of Baghdad's main allies, the United States and Iran, who use Iraq as a proxy in a struggle for regional influence. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
Observers say moves by Lebanese President Michel Aoun to entrench his position will only escalate political and economic tensions. There are growing popular demands to get rid of the ruling elite, tackle corruption, and provide basic public services in the tiny Mediterranean company once called the Switzerland of the Middle East. Protesters have blocked some roads in Beirut and other parts of the country as they press for reforms, stepping up pressure at a time of acute economic crises. Dale Gavlek reports for VOA from Beirut.
Analyst Mohamed Haj Ali of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut tells VOA that he and other observers see Sunday's rally of President Michel Aoun's supporters as a way of pushing back on the popular protests demanding concrete change gripping Lebanon.
He is moving from the defensive position, trying to entrench himself within the political system. It was a way to contest the popular movement, basically telling the protesters that here I am, I have my own popularity. You don't represent everyone. This is my version of the events, a reinstatement of the status quo that he represents. It wasn't reconciliatory, it's distortion. People were angry and this pushed people to go back to the streets and into blocking the roads.
Haj Ali says ordinary Lebanese are resentful of the president's son-in-law and Lebanese foreign minister, Gibran Bassel, who they see using his position to benefit himself and jockeying for the presidency. He says Lebanese are fearful that Aoun and Bassel will simply escalate an already potentially volatile situation by reappointing disgraced Prime Minister Saad Hariri, who stepped down due to popular demands.
The whole presidency has been marked by this out-of-touchness. The son-in-law is living in a world of his own. He is running the show in the presidency. And he is the face of this detached government. He came out saying, you know, my street versus your street. Kind of a call for an escalation rather than calming people down. People are hearing on the street is there will be a Hariri-led government and Gibran Bassel wants to stay in it.
Powerful Lebanese Druze leader Walid Jumblat has criticized Aoun, saying his allowing the government to stay on in a caretaker capacity until a new cabinet is formed violated the constitution. He says that after the popular movement had brought down most, if not all, of the political class, Aoun undermined the constitution to serve the interests of the despotism of one person and a useless political movement. Meanwhile, another Carnegie analyst says Lebanon has the third highest level of public debt in the world, equivalent to 150% of GDP, and is in deep recession while inequality grows, public services fail, and the infrastructure crumbles. The country is on the verge of economic collapse unless an immediate solution can be found to end days of nationwide protests that have paralyzed the country, the central bank governor Riyad Salami recently told CNN. Observers say the political system that has dominated Lebanon since an agreement ending its 1975 to 1990 civil war has led to decades of corruption and economic mismanagement that have culminated in a severe financial crisis. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Beirut.
Iran on Monday broke further away from its collapsing 2015 nuclear deal with world powers by announcing its doubling of the number of advanced centrifuges it operates, calling the decision a direct result of U.S. President Donald Trump's withdrawal from the agreement. The announcement came as demonstrators across the country marked the 40th anniversary of the 1979 U.S. embassy takeover that started a 444-day hostage crisis. By starting up these advanced centrifuges, Iran further cuts into the 1 year that experts estimate Tehran would need to have enough material for building a nuclear weapon if it chooses to pursue one. Seven Southeast Asian leaders skipped an important meeting with the United States on Monday after President Trump decided not to attend their regional summit in Thailand. Rather than Trump, the U.S. sent recent appointed National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien to the Association of Southeast Asian Nations gathering. The move contrasts with other allies of the 10-member regional bloc who sent their heads of government. Only host Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha of Thailand and the prime ministers of Vietnam and Laos joined O'Brien and the foreign ministers sent by other countries. One person died and at least 34 were injured Monday in a grenade attack in the Indian-administered Kashmir's main city of Srinagar. Indian officials said in the bloodiest incident since New Delhi stripped the region of special status on August 5th. Britain lowered its national terrorism threat level to substantial from severe on Monday. The substantial threat level continued to indicate a high level of threat and an attack might occur without further warning. A federal appeals court ruled today that U.S. President Donald Trump's longtime accounting firm must hand over 8 years of his tax returns to New York prosecutors. It's a latest setback for Trump and his efforts to keep his finances secret. With the Republican president set to appeal, the ruling sets the stage for an expected showdown in the U.S. Supreme Court, whose 5-4 conservative majority includes two justices appointed by Mr. Trump. On Capitol Hill today, four administration officials were scheduled to testify before the impeachment inquiry committees. Now joining us in the studio to bring us up to date on the latest proceedings and all that's happening on Capitol Hill is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Welcome to the program, Catherine.
Thanks so much.
So what can you tell us of what is kind of breaking right now as we're going to air?
Right. So as we're going to air right now, we're actually getting some of the first transcripts from the House Intelligence Committee's closed-door hearings. These are incredibly important because they're going to be giving us the full picture of what's been going on these past few weeks as Democrats and Republicans interview key witnesses in the impeachment inquiry, a whole range of State Department and other officials who are involved in U.S.-Ukraine policy and are providing investigators with a fuller picture of what happened with that President Trump phone call with the Ukrainian president.
Yeah, so we're going to get those either later today, perhaps in the near future, as well as other transcripts. But earlier today, there were supposed to be a number of people who were going to testify, but they opted not to.
That's right. So that's actually a sign that the closed door section of this impeachment inquiry is winding down, and that what's going to be happening next are these public hearings that House Democrats voted to start last week with that rules procedural vote that started a new phase of the impeachment inquiry, really time for those public officials to come out, talk in public, and make the case to the American people people on the House Democrats' part as to whether there should be an impeachment of President Trump.
Now, the committee chairs, since they invited these individuals to appear and testify before their committees, they said that they would not. What is the committee going to do next? Are they going to issue subpoenas to try to compel them, or what has the White House said in regards to that?
Right. So part of that impeachment vote last week was to formalize the impeachment inquiry and take away one of the arguments that President Donald Trump and Republicans have made, is that because it's not a formal inquiry, they don't have to comply with the subpoenas. Well, now it is a formal inquiry. Now we are in a new phase of that process. Now the House Democrats can issue those subpoenas. What I do expect is that they're going to be talking to some of the people who did comply with the subpoenas, Volker, Vonlin, all of those people who have already come before the committee behind closed doors. We'll now be hearing from them in public at public hearings.
Really quickly now, the whistleblower started this all off. Mr. Trump says the whistleblower should come forward to testify. The whistleblower's attorney said that he would be willing, or she would be willing, to answer some questions, correct?
Oh, absolutely, yes. So the attorney said over the weekend that they would be able to answer written, submitted questions from both Democrats and Republicans. And Republicans came out over the weekend and said that that wouldn't be enough, that they want to get that whistleblower into a hearing. And I'm sure that they would want that hearing to be public as well.
VOA's Catherine Gibson reports for us from Capitol Hill. Thank you very much for joining us in the studio.
You're so welcome.
After taking about 2 years, President Trump can finally formally start withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement. AP correspondent Ben Thomas has more.
I followed through on my promise to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord.
That was President Trump, June 8, 2017. But technically, the U.S. is still in. The terms of the Paris Agreement say no country can withdraw in the first 3 years. It took effect November 4, 2016, so that means today is the first day the U.S. can start the withdrawal process. A letter to the U.N. will trigger it, and it will take a year to complete. That'll be the day after the 2020 presidential election. Ben Thomas, Washington.
And you're listening to VOA News.
I'm a sucker for love. Hi, I'm Larry London. Don't miss your chance to get the Now 71 CD, including some of the top hit songs of today's biggest stars.
I can't write one song that's not about you. Can't drink without.
The CD features Billie Eilish's Bad Guy.
So you're a tough guy, like you're really rough guy. Just can't get enough guy, just always so puff guy. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type.
Lil Nas X, Old Town Road.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride.
And many of the greatest hits. You can only get the chance to win by listening to Border Crossings. Tune us in every day at 1500 UTC.
International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Protests rocked Hong Kong over the weekend, leaving several people critically injured. Reuters' Eve Johnson has the details.
Protests in Hong Kong took a bloody turn over the weekend. In one shocking incident, a district councillor was attacked by an unidentified man who bit off part of his ear. On Monday, the councillor's colleague stepped out to try and reassure a community on edge.
We really see that people are very heavy-hearted. They don't know what's going to happen tonight or maybe the next weekend, and there's a lot of worry.
The incident began at a shopping mall packed with families and children. What started as a peaceful protest quickly turned chaotic when riot police stormed the place and a man with a knife went on a stabbing spree outside. District Councillor Andrew Chiu tried to intervene and the attacker turned on him. The man was finally subdued and beaten by protesters. The weekend's demonstrations targeted metro stations and businesses, including the Xinhua News Agency, the local outpost for mainland China's state media. The attack sparked a stony rebuke on Monday, with state media urging Hong Kong to take a tougher line with protesters. Activists have kept up a months-long campaign against what they see as China's meddling with their freedoms. For some residents, clashes on the street have become almost a routine.
It's nothing special now. As you know, every time after the protest, everything returns to normal very quickly. Life goes on.
Protesters are already planning new rallies. A call has gone out on social media to mark Guy Fawkes Day on November 5th by wearing face masks. Leader Carrie Lam recently banned masks. Anyone caught wearing one during a public gathering could be subject to arrest.
And that was Reuters reporter Eve Johnson. State media have reported that police in Vietnam have arrested 8 people in connection with the discovery of 39 dead people, all believed to be Vietnamese, in a truck near London last month. That's bringing the total number of arrests in Vietnam to 10. British police last week charged 2 men with manslaughter over the deaths of the group, whose bodies were found inside a container on a truck on October 23rd. Joining us now in the studio with more is VOA Vietnamese service reporter Ha Nguyen. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
So what can you share with us about the arrests in Vietnam?
So the chief of the police in Nghệ An province, where a lot of people came to UK, and looks like a lot of them were among the deaf people, he said on the Vietnamese media that those people who have been arrested are in a ring that they've been investigating since last month, right after the news about the 39 people found dead in the lorry in the UK.
And this is a human trafficking ring, smuggling?
Yeah, but he didn't call that. It's a smuggling, because those people, they paid them like $20,000-$30,000 to go abroad illegally. But the ring, yes, the ring were organized, and they are bringing those people, to the Europe illegally. So yes, I mean, but he didn't call that a kind of smuggling, because they paid them to go abroad. Yeah.
Last week, we spoke with Tuc Pham from the Vietnamese service as well, and he shared with us that the service has been in contact with a family whose son went missing just before the truck was found. Are there any updates you can share with
yes,
us?
Yes, actually, I was the person who talked to the father of the son, and today I follow up with them, and they got a very sad news, his son was among the dead people. And last week I was talking to him, and he said he was praying that his son was not in 39 people who died in that truck. But sadly, it was Jews.
The family got positive identification. Have all the bodies been identified at this point?
At this point, no. Yeah, but we've heard that only 4 people have been identified. But I talked today, follow up with 2 of them, and they said, yes, they got the news. Very sad news.
Very sad indeed. Yeah. Ha Nguyen reports for VOA from the Vietnamese service. Thank you very much for stopping down and joining us in the studio today.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. This week marks the 30th year that has passed since the Berlin Wall fell, ending the divide between the communist East and the democratic West. The wall's demise brought an end to a divided Berlin and symbolized the eventual liberation of East Germany and later the rest of Europe from the Soviet communist rule. What was the significance of the wall going up and the lasting impact in the region after it came down 30 years ago? For that, I asked Johanna Schuster-Craig, assistant professor of German and global studies at Michigan State University.
You know, that happened at multiple levels. So the immediate impact is that some families were separated and split in half. There had been a joint German Olympic team between East and West, which is a little known fact that a lot of people don't know. They competed under the same team and under the same citizenship category. That was no longer an option after the border was secured. And primarily, you had a lot of people in East Germany that had actually been commuting to the West for work and then coming back home to the East to be with their families. And that source of manpower was also cut off. Not only did Eastern Germans lose their jobs because they couldn't get to them, but the West lost a critical source of manpower. And so the construction of the Berlin Wall didn't just affect East Germans by keeping people in the East. It also affected the ability of West Germans to staff jobs, staff factories, and one of the effects was that is that the West started turning more and more to guest worker labor, which significantly also changed the identity of West Germany for the future.
Going back to the families, because my personal history is that I was a correspondent in Seoul, South Korea for a number of years, and they deal with the separation of families between North and South Korea after the end of the Korean War. How did families in Berlin and in Germany deal with that kind of separation?
I think every family was different. As time progressed, West families could get travel waivers to come into the East and sometimes would bring consumer goods from the West to their families in the East. But if you look at the pictures of what the construction looked like, you know, we think of now the Berlin Wall as these huge slabs of concrete, and we think of it in its advanced state. But in the beginning, it was boarded up houses and barbed wire fence and structures that were simply patrolled and securing the border. So you do have some dramatic scenes in 1961 when the wall goes up of people jumping out of windows or soldiers defecting by jumping over the barbed wire fence. Konrad Schumann has a memorial up in the Bernauer Straße in Berlin because he was one of the soldiers that jumped the fence in uniform. But I think mostly what you had was simply East German families being cut off from relatives for decades.
Fast forward to 30 years, we're coming up on the anniversary of the wall coming down. What was the significance in 1989 of that wall coming down and essentially reuniting the two halves of the city?
It was the end of the Cold War. It was the end of communism as a second world system. And so in that sense, it's a global event. The global event of the fall of the wall is something that I try to impress upon my students, because any global event that's of that much importance that causes massive shifts in society is contested. So there's the narrative of East Germans who had organized and come together politically to fight for a democratic regime change and the end of communism. That's one part of the narrative. But then there's also the counter narrative, where some people are very critical of what happened in the peaceful revolution and see reunification not necessarily as just a positive thing, but as a positive thing that also just opened up Eastern Europe for capitalist economic exploitation. So the fall of the wall is something that we commemorate that certainly has a prominent place in West German history and East German history and the history of reunified Germany, but there's no master narrative that can tell us, oh, this was a perfect event, this was a wonderful event. It was a complex event, and it had different effects on different groups of people.
So what are some of those effects that have been long-lasting as we move essentially a generation past the fall of the wall?
This is something that's quite interesting to me. So the Berlin Institute for Population and Development published a really interesting study in 2015, and the subtitle of this study was called How Divided Germany Has Grown Together. And one of the things they did in this study was to take data that they had collected, quantitative data, and then visualize it in the form of German maps. And what emerged is that you could still see the division. You could still see in the colored maps that they produced the differences between East and West that persist after a generation. And some of those things are obvious, perhaps. There's less purchasing power for high-end goods in the East, and there's more acceptance of immigrants in the West because there are more immigrants in the West. But one of the things that's super interesting is that because the infrastructure in East Germany wasn't so great, East Germans actually use renewable energy sources 9 percentage points more than West Germans do now. They also have a higher rate of coal usage, but there's that mixed picture.
And that was Johanna Schuster-Craig, Assistant Professor of German and Global Studies at Michigan State University. Gert Boyle, the colorful chairwoman of the Oregon-based Columbia Sportswear Company, who starred in ads proclaiming her as one tough mother, died on Sunday. She was 95. The ad showed Boyle putting her son, Tim, the president of the company, through treacherous outdoor feats to ensure their products met her tough standards. An iconic photo from the campaign which has her arms flexing, bearing an emblazoned tattoo that said Born to Nag, still hangs in the company's Beaverton headquarters. And with that, that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of both of our producers today, Dan Brown and Des McKinnon, engineer John Dryden, and managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, thank you very much for listening. You can find more news and world events on our website. And don't forget, with our mobile app, you can download the stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.